sign up for pathway to mentorship classes, including welcome to Unity, our class for newcomers. I want to draw your attention to the bulletin inside your order of service this week at Unity, which serves as an invitation and roadmap to deeper involvement in the life of the church. Author and Unity Church member Amy Funpower Miller will read from her book, She Looks Just Like You, a memoir of non-biological lesbian motherhood, at Wellspring Wednesday this week. Wellspring Wednesday evenings begin at
just over 400 pledges, totaling $780,000. So thank you. Generosity of spirit does lead to a warmer sanctuary. We are well on our way to canvassing every household at Unity, either with a canvas visit or through a phone call. We've endeavored to reach each and all. If you haven't had an opportunity to make your pledge, you may do so after the service at the pledge table in the parish hall, or we now have pledging online. Go to unityunitarian.org, click on pledge information, and that will lead you to the pledge card. As Rob mentioned last week, we are deep into the budgeting process for 2011. Our pledges make up 82% of the church's operating budget, the budget that goes before the congregation on November 20th. And we need to know soon what kind of pledge income we can count on for the coming year. We do have a goal to raise our pledge base by 5% for 2011. This will enable us to bring staff salaries back into market range, something we are directed to do by our governing policies. We have a wealth of Sundays this month. There are five. And we are a week away from the end of the pledge drive. Come next Sunday, the 31st, we'll have no tricks for you. But the treat will be the last of these reminders from the lantern.
Each week when we gather, the overwhelming majority of our
myself from the family, society, nation, and from all humankind, it is but for a moment. Practically, I am bound up with all the world, an integer, indeed, but a fraction of humankind. We all desire this complete joy. We are not content without it. I feel it belongs to me, to all people as individuals and as fractions of society. When humankind comes of age, we must enter this estate. The very desire thereof shows it as a part of the divine plan of the world. For each natural instinct has the means to satisfy it, put somewhere in the universe. And there is a mutual attraction between the two, which at last must meet. Natural desire is the prophecy of satisfaction.
If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal. described as an iron cage those problems that he saw as endemic to modern capitalism: a lack of personal autonomy, an overvaluing of rational calculative thought as opposed to emotional morality, and an increasing reliance on bureaucracy. Considered at the level of individual, Weber's thesis implies that the cage of ideology is always to some extent self-imposed, or at least self-approved. As individuals, we must become caged. Cage is not our nature. And to varying degrees, we are each somewhat complicit in the design of our own cages. Modern capitalism and consumerism, therefore, shapes and limits our imagination as consumers. This limitation is what I mean by a cage. The second metal zone is that of desire. In 1906, a merchant named John Wanamaker described this country as a land of desire. He was prefiguring what would be a century-long infatuation with desire, a search for the latent primal urges that motivate and compel the behavior of individuals in society. Business leaders, political figures, celebrities, academics, church leaders, even military strategists and thinkers, everyone was fascinated with desire. Still is, especially with its predictive and manipulative promises. One Lehman Brothers executive in the 1930s remarked, "We must shift America from a needs to a desires culture. People must be trained to desire, to want new things, even before the old have been entirely consumed. Man's desires must overshadow his needs." The third and final pedal tone was first sounded in a reading earlier in this service, a prophecy of satisfaction. This idea comes from an 1851 sermon by Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. You've already heard the reading, but I'd like to again emphasize the last two lines. They are, "It is a part of the divine plan for the world, for each natural desire has the means to satisfy it put somewhere in the universe, and there is a mutual attraction between the two, which at last must meet. Natural desire is the prophecy satisfaction." This statement is radical, and it requires some unpacking. Many of us know Barber's famous line about the arc of the universe bending toward justice. It was used by Martin Luther King Jr., and it gets considerable airtime in our congregations. Well, the prophecy of satisfaction fits right into the arc. Parker's ethic suggests that there are some transcendental desires placed deep within individual humans, natural desires that are in keeping with the design and arc of the universe. To not a one-time phenomenon, to be sure. It must happen with every breath. A constant return to the questions that motivate us. A constant interrogation of the fears that keep us divided. A constant vigilance of our own complicity in designing our own cage. This is what is required for our radiance. But the cultural forces of desire are marshaled against the development of personal authenticity, of independence, and of free thought. It has been this way as long as humans have carried power over one another, and it continues this way today. I'm going to continue with a brief history of marketed desire, and I encourage you to mark those threads in your mind that you see in effect today. There are many, I think. The flood of marketed desire that we experience daily in advertising, press, and political messages began in this country at the turn of the 20th century. The new machinery of the Industrial Revolution had dramatically increased productive capacity, and for the first time, producers of goods were consistently able to outproduce demand. One New York Times article at the time called it need saturation. Industry could now produce in a few months what would satisfy demand over a full year. This concerned the captains of industry, who saw idle capacity as wasted money and feared a radicalized working class. They saw new ways to entice people's needs and spending. Political leaders feared the mob, a dissatisfied public, and sought new ways to pacify and defang the masses and entrench their own appeal. Academic institutions reflected what was to become a cultural shift. At Harvard in 1914, a business course that had for a while been called Economic Resources United States was renamed simply marketing. Concurrently, the field of psychoanalysis was experiencing the formation of the mark of Sigmund Freud. Freud's main thrust was his suggestion that there are hidden unconscious desires that drive individuals. His work would be used to explain the discontent of the masses of the Russian Revolution and the frenzied stock crash of 1929. The implied warning: satisfy the public's desires or face certain instability, violence, and chaos. Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays, is today often referred to as the progenitor of the public relations industry. Using his uncle's discovery of the unconscious, Bernays began crafting new marketing messages based not upon functionality or product attributes, but upon how whatever he was selling would indulge a person's ego or make them feel good about themselves. For example, he would sell a screwdriver not by talking about how well he drove screws, but by showing how it, or describing how it can make a person feel. For example, more helpful, productive, handy, or more of a man. By the late 1920s, thanks largely to the work of Bernays and company, the demand problem was nearly solved. People were wanting things. They yearned for products that expressed their personality. Industry was kept busy and the masses were pacified by the consistent manufacture and delivery of consumer desires. In 1927, one journalist wrote, "A change has come over our democracy. It is called consumptionism. The American citizen's first importance to his country is no longer that of a citizen, but that of a consumer." 1 year later, President Hoover addressed leaders of industry. "You have taken over the job of creating desire and have transformed people into constantly moving happiness machines. Machines which have become key to economic progress. By advertising and other promotional devices, we have found a boundless field before us, that there are new wants which will make way endlessly for newer wants as fast as they are satisfied." Thus, the cage of desire in its crude initial form was constructed with the willing, often eager participation of the American consuming public. Now, Freud was dead by the time of World War II, but his theories about the ego and the conscious had taken hold in the halls of power. In the 50s, the CIA dumped millions of dollars into psychology departments at universities across the nation, and Bernays was called in to advise Eisenhower. Not the first time he advised the president. His suggestion about the rising communist threat: do not reduce the public sphere, instead encourage and manipulate it. Rene sincerely believed in this process. He legitimated it, calling it the engineering of purposes. I don't think he felt all those publics out there had reliable judgment, that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above. Marketing and public relations continued in this vein largely until the mid-60s, when things began to change. The 1962 suicide of Marilyn Monroe cast public doubt upon a social order and a psychological treatment that demanded conformity to a normal American life. In the academies, cultural critics were establishing strongholds. The Frankfurt School used Marxist theories to examine the production of culture. In particular, how intentional production of false consciousness could contribute to a society's ongoing domination. The sexual revolution reminded people of the sensuality of their bodies, while bebop and rock and roll music shook people and stirred them from their assigned seats. The Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, and the civil rights movement challenged preferential assumptions and questioned society's moral stance. Martin Luther King, in 1967, said, "Modern psychology has a word that is used probably more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. It is the ringing cry of modern child psychology, maladjusted." Now, of course, we all want to live a well-adjusted life, but I would like to say to you today, in a very honest manner, that there are some things in our society and some things in our world to which I am proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. Market and desire here was far from defeated, but the game was definitely changing. People had become critical of the establishment, of any establishment. They no longer saw conformity as therapeutic. Conformity repressed exactly what needed to be said. Thus, the marketing atmosphere that emerged from the 60s had become one of feeding and indulging desires. The era of merely repressing or controlling desires was at an end. Focus groups, another legacy of Freud, became all the rage as market researchers who once sought consumers' interest in pre-existing products now probed the inner depths of consumers to find out just what they thought they needed to make them feel more like themselves. This gave the illusion of greater liberation, of greater personal expression through a diverse multitude of products by asking, is it truly freedom? Or is it the same passive reactivity with simply more choices to choose from? Our modern productive capacity delivers the illusion of limitless choices. But they are never truly our own, are they? Robert Wright, former Secretary of Labor and current professor at the University of California at Berkeley, suggests that the real effect of this turn towards individualism is that everything in the world, all moral judgment, can now be viewed legitimately through a lens of personal satisfaction. This individualist turn infects political races too, like some form of ideological kudzu. Lifestyle concerns achieving priority over legislative issues. A now famous example, Dick Morris, while he was working for Bill Clinton, specifically targeted suburban swing voters, polling them on issues of identity and personal preference. The result was a series of brief appearances by Clinton that reflected constituents' identities back to them via clothing and catchphrases. The strategy worked. Robert Wright stated, "The people who ultimately got to the president shared the president's mind with those who viewed the voters just as a collection of individual desires that had to be catered to and suggests that democracy is nothing more and should be nothing more than pandering to these unthought about, very primitive desires. Primitive in the sense that they are not even necessarily conscious, just what people want in terms of satisfying themselves." Some of you may be grateful to history and Faber and so many others were right. This question of what is valuable is a question both economic and religious in its design. Why religious? Because it speaks of human nature. Because it speaks of what constitutes a good life. Because it affects the growth of healthy, grounded individuals. Because selfishness does not deliver the kind of relationships which are the deep yearnings and the longings of the human heart. Because false consciousness is just that. And because, as we read together, that which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and our character. And because, quite simply, discernment hurts. The darkness around us is deep indeed, and the practice of living authentically can be a painful and tiring process. This is especially true in a society in which so many voices clamor for your attention, for your desire. There are voices about appearances, about vocation, about race and gender and sexuality. There are voices who would pretend to know what you need based upon the toothpaste you prefer, or the person who received your last rheumatoid code, or the color of your skin, or how long you've been out of work. The chorus of identity, of consumption of identity, is grows steadily louder. The noise at times can be deafening. And the time and space for healing, for discernment, for listening to our inner voice always seems most fleeting when we need it the most. What I'm proposing this morning, in light of the historical and present forms of coercive desire, is that religious community, our religious community, is a place where we are called to explore our natural desires as individuals, to organize in their common pursuit, and to find mutual support in our daily struggles for authenticity. The prevalence of marketed desire and the equally destructive impulse to tune out completely simply makes more valuable and more necessary a kind of relationship that is free of coercion, that elevates compassion beyond identity and common good above individualism, a kind of bond that discerns natural desires from marketed desires. Kind of company that will stand with you, maladjusted still to the cages that remain. We can be a crucible for one another's endless formation, if only we are brave enough to remain awake ourselves. Rob spoke last week about the paradox of giving up ideas of the self in order to develop a more enduring sense of self. It sounds counterintuitive, but in fact it is spot on. And of paramount importance in the age of marketed desire. The message of the life of Jesus was to find life, to lose life, and to find life again. We need not die to accomplish the truth of this teaching, the renewal of an uncaged self, capable of deep compassion in the face of darkness and great mystery. As we move slowly and steadily into our next monthly worship theme of covenant, I hope that you will wonder with me, what kind of bond helps people find and maintain not only their balance, but also their authenticity? Can we trust the commonality of our natural desires? How can we be of help to one another and to the world in the face of marketed desire and coercion? My wish for each of you this day is to be ever so much more than happiness machines. Find a stillness. Hold a stillness. Yes, a stillness away from marketed desire and the noisy parade of products and people who claim that you need them to truly be you. But even more, find a stillness within. Hold it. If not for yourself, if you've already got it all figured out, then hold a stillness for your neighbor, for someone who needs that space. There are many among us. Conjure a stillness that knows no path, a stillness that knows no desire. will be